Hey, y'all, you may have heard that me and Ebony just wrote a book, and it is out now, so please go check it out. It is about women who've been written out of history. It has beautiful illustrations, and we're really excited about it. So if you'd like to get a copy, just go to historyversuswomen.com.
Yeah. Oh, no, yeah, Anita, you're going to love this.
Is Johnny Depp out?
Ha! No. It's even better than that. And by better, I mean worse.
Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 46, and I'm your host, Anita Sarkeesian. I'm joined by my fellow monsters and women, Ebony Astor and Carolyn Pettit.
Rawr.
Wow. Good morning.
This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, we are the feminist killjoys coming for your media, depending on your perspective. Today's show centers on the 2018 drama Monsters and Men. The film presents the aftermath of a highly charged police shooting in Brooklyn and the ripple effects of the three different men of color. After that, we'll finish the show by each sharing a little something in What's Your Freakout? Now, on with the show. What's up, y'all?
What's up?
What's up is that I had to get up extra early this morning to be here because we're starting early this morning for reasons. And yeah, you know,
those reasons are important reasons. It's because Anita and I are about to moonwalk across the country.
That's right.
On our book tour. So we will not be available to record at our normal time next week.
Yes, we're recording two episodes.
That's right.
This is all inside baseball. No one but us cares about.
Yeah, but, you know, right now I've got that. I feel like because I got up early, I have, like, extra energy, but that means also that, like, I'm going to crash at some point. You know, you've got that, like, kind of frantic.
Yeah, so the second episode is going to be super shitty.
That's right.
Oh, no, wait, because like, I think
it's going to be gold. It's going to be our best episode ever.
But yes. The next episode is real special.
It is.
So
it is.
Maybe that'll give you a boost.
It might. It just might.
All right, Caro, you got any entertainment news for us?
Yeah, I do. As everyone, I'm sure, has heard by now, Bill Cosby has been sentenced.
Who?
He was a famous comedian a while ago. He had like a TV show where he was a wholesome dad. Turns out he's a serial rapist and sexual abuser.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
Also, he sold Jell-O pudding pops and stuff to children. So he's been sentenced to
commercials, Anita, not like personally out of the trunk of his car.
I mean, still, he is a horrible man.
I
am familiar with Bill Cosby and his repertoire. Thanks. I didn't expect Carolyn to take that bit so far.
So, yeah, it's because the sentencing, the unusual sentencing, the 3 to 10 years, he's going to serve no fewer than 3, no more than 10. And it is because this trial that he was convicted on was actually only for one incident of sexual of rape. So even though he has, women he has abused numbering in the dozens, literally, this was only about. This case only covered one specific incident. A lot of cases are no longer within the statute of limitations, unfortunately. And so he is like eligible for parole after 3 years, but could serve up to 10 years. Hallelujah. I am so glad that this man is finally seeing some kind of reckoning for his, you know, his just monstrous, horrible, horrible, horrible behavior. So I want to be very clear that what I'm about to say is not at all like this is not fair to Bill Cosby. This is absolutely, you know, what Bill Cosby deserves. But there's also like that small part of me that can't help but think, okay, but when are men like Harvey Weinstein and you know, Kevin Spacey or, you know, these like white powerful men, like, is it partially because he's black that he is the one who has been convicted of this? Like, you know, I can't get that thought out of my head. And it's like,
yeah,
it does bother me a little bit.
Yeah, just like Carol, without, you know, trying to suggest that Bill Cosby should not pay for his crimes, it is impossible not to to wrestle with the idea that, you know, it is easier to punish the black brute when it fits an already established narrative, right? When it's safe, essentially, to do so. And also, you know, taking note of the fact that this has happened like decades after this dude has just been allowed to, you know, ruin the lives of so many women, you know? And so the images that we're seeing of him are of this, you know, like stooped, you know, 80-year-old man. And I'm just like, when is this shit? When are people going to reckon with it? When are these women, when are we going to find justice in the moment? You know, why is it always like justice deferred?
Right.
So I have some things.
Yeah.
Have there been charges brought up against Weinstein and Spacey? You know, like, so clearly charges were brought up. It went to court.
Yeah.
That, you know, there's enough, like, quote unquote, evidence to do that. And I'm wondering if, like, the difference is there have been accusations, but no, like, actual lawsuit or
no, I believe
criminal, the criminal charges.
Right. Yeah, charges have been filed against Weinstein. I believe no in the case of Spacey. As far as I know, it's all at this point civil.
I mean, yeah, to be fair, the ball did start rolling for, you know, this Cosby conviction like years ago.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously, like, yes, that there is that factor. So, you know, again, I'm
not to discount at all what you're
no,
what
right.
both of you are saying. Just curious, because I feel like this stuff just takes a long time to get rolling.
Of
and
course.
Like the Cosby stuff came out earlier.
Yes.
The other thing I keep thinking about here, too, is, you know, we talk about, well, Ebony has, but we talk generally about prison abolition. And I've talked a lot about restorative justice on this podcast in terms of how do we actually like heal and move forward. And I always feel a little bit of tension in these spaces where I'm like, the way that we serve justice, quote unquote, is by putting people in jail. And there's nothing restorative. There's nothing transformative. There's no process to heal those who have been harmed. There's no process to try and create real change in the people who have done harm, if there is any possibility of it. And so it's just, it's frustrating to me that that's all we have. And like, we are rooting to put people in jail when I don't believe
right.
in the justice system.
Right.
And so it's frustrating because you're like, yes, I want there to be some kind of penalty for this. I want there to be this symbolic understanding that like, you can't get away with this, but I don't like what that practically means in our society.
100%.
I think a lot of the discussion about like restorative justice, rehabilitation, so much of the arguments against it spring from a misunderstanding that people who talk about like the abolition of prisons or of traditional forms of law enforcement are simply advocating that we like today get rid of prisons, you know, abolish the police, right? But what we're actually talking about is a fundamental reformation of society, such that we're not talking about people who do horrible acts, you know, getting just like pats on the head and sitting in, you know, circles singing Kumbaya. Like, that's not what it's about. It's about reforming society such that we are able to heal the sicknesses that cause these things to occur in advance. And so, yeah, we're talking long term in a lot of ways, but we have to start this action now. Because as you say, like the kind of solutions, the resolution rather, of putting an abuser, a rapist, you know, in jail, yes, it pulls that person off the street, you know, temporarily, perhaps permanently, but it doesn't actually heal anyone, and it doesn't do anything to then subvert like the root causes of why these actions occur.
Yeah, John Wetzel, the Pennsylvania Corrections Secretary, told CNN about Cosby right now he's in special circumstances as they're trying to determine, you know, he's 81 years old, you know, roughly, he has eyesight problems and so on. You know, if he can be integrated into the standard prison population. But he did say, quote, "The long term goal is for Cosby to be placed in the general population to receive the programming required during his incarceration." And I'm like,
weird.
What like programming are you talking about? Like, there is no. Yeah, like that is not how our justice system works, that there's some kind of helpful, beneficial programming.
Right.
Anyway. Yeah. My other story this week concerns the Potterverse.
What?
So yeah, so there was a new trailer released for the Fantastic Beasts:
oh,
The Crimes of Grindelwald.
Nope.
Yeah.
I'm out.
Oh no, Anita, you're gonna love this.
Is Johnny Depp out?
Ha! No. It's even better than that. And by better, I mean worse. okay, so in the Potter books, there is a character named Nagini, who is Voldemort's trusted snake and the location of one of his Horcruxes.
Oh no, what are they gonna do?
Oh yeah, oh yeah, Anita. In the new trailer, it is revealed that Nagini is actually a human woman.
Shut up.
Yes. Played by an Asian actor, Claudia Kim.
What?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm referring here to a story by Kaylee Donaldson on the website pajiba.com. And she says, you know, don't worry if you're feeling a bit weird about the fact that Neville Longbottom actually murdered a woman and not just a snake. East Asian voices on Twitter have kind of risen up to strongly criticize.
Does she transform into a snake?
So here's Rowling's explanation.
Oh fuck, I don't even want to hear this shit.
Let's see. So she is one of the Maledictuses. Maledictuses are women who suffer from a blood curse that will eventually transform them into beasts. The curse is passed from mother to daughter, and the Maledictus has no escape from her fate. Eventually, her body will trap her in the form of an animal.
Isn't that convenient?
Yeah.
A blood curse, you get it?
And yeah, so this is sort of the latest in, you know, in Rowling's maybe misguided attempts to retroactively bring more diversity to the Potterverse, but she always does it in ways that, like, she doesn't realize are inherently fucked up. Rowling tweeted in defense of herself, you know, the Naga are snake-like mythical creatures of Indonesian mythology, hence the name Nagini. They are sometimes depicted as winged, sometimes half human, half snake. Indonesia comprises a few hundred ethnic groups, including Javanese, Chinese, and Batawi. Have a lovely day, you know, trying to defend, like, the origins of this thing. And somebody replied to her tweet, you know, actually, the Naga mythology emerged from India. It traveled to Indonesia with the Indic Hindu empires that emerged there in the early Common Era, with the influence of Indian traders and rishikas who traveled there. Nagin is a Sanskrit language word. So anyway, also, it's super weird now to think that Voldemort, throughout the main books, like, drank Nagini's milk to sustain himself and stay alive.
I hate everything. Stop ruining everything.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like Harry Potter was this bastion of amazingness before, but, like, just stop making it worse.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Also, if you are a white creative and people from, you know, a certain community say, hey, you know what, I find this makes me a little bit uncomfortable, the response should never be, let me tell you more about your history and why it's okay that I've done this.
Did you know that it's because of you that we can keep bringing Feminist Frequency Radio to the airwaves? It's true. If you're enjoying our show, please consider joining our podcast community at d.rip/femfreak, where you'll get access to some fun perks and bonus episodes. That's d.rip/femfreak. And if you're a founding member, then you should be getting or should have gotten a little something from us in the mail. So keep your eyes peeled for that.
Oh, boy. All right. We should move on.
Okay.
To...
let's get away from this horribleness of
I don't like it.
An Asian woman being transformed.
Let's talk about police brutality.
Yay! Oh no.
In our main topic for today.
Yes.
All right. Today's main topic is the film Monsters and Men. It is a newly released drama from director Ronaldo Marcus Green that's loosely based on the 2014 murder of Eric Garner. It takes place in New York City via three interconnected vignettes about how police violence affects Black communities. Yeah. So that's the movie.
Yeah.
Okay. So I didn't know that it was took place in vignettes. I hope that that's not a spoil. I mean, it's the structure of the movie, which I think is actually a really, I liked that they did that.
Yeah.
So we're following three different black men in Brooklyn who experience the over-policing, the racial profiling, and
Manny,
the violence.
Is Manny black?
I think so.
Okay.
Is he?
I mean, I think he's supposed to.
I didn't read him. I didn't read him as black.
I don't read him as black, but I think he's supposed to. Like, he said the N-word.
Right. I caught that, but I actually wanted to talk about that because my reading of him was of a, you know, typical kind of like Latinx figure. I believe he's Puerto Rican. I thought I saw a Puerto Rican flag on the wall, which is not to say you can't be black and Puerto Rican, but my reading of it was that this was about black
actually,
and
that,
brown
and that would sort of change. That would change a tiny bit. I mean, it's not like Latinx communities aren't over-policed either. I read him that way as well, but I just assumed that if he's using the N-word openly, that he is at least like half black. But that's an unfair assumption
Also because, you know, as you said, this is based loosely on the murder of Eric Garner by NYPD police. The person that Manny's character mirrors is the real life figure of Ramsey Orta, who I do not believe is black.
That was the
young man who shot
Eric
Garner.
Well, then
shit,
he shouldn't be saying the N-word.
Well, no, he shouldn't. But I think, you know, this film has a wonderful way of showing like the kind of vivid tapestry of these different communities that are woven together in Brooklyn, such that you do have, and it's problematic as fuck, but you do have folks who feel free to use the term nigga because like the people around them use it. They hear it in, you know, the music that they listen to.
Wasn't there a whole thing with J-Lo using the N-word in one of her songs because she grew up in around black community?
I don't know. And you know what? I refuse to Google because I just don't need that in my spirit.
Yeah,
today.
I just remember it being something like that where everyone was like, what the fuck? Because you're not black.
But she's J-Lo from the block.
And maybe the block is black. I don't know.
Doesn't matter.
No, I do. That's why it was such a huge controversy.
This is a note for our listening audience. Like, you don't get a pass. You know, no one gets a pass.
Yeah, so,
So for listeners, let me just quickly break down that. So you have three vignettes. The first is Manny, the individual who films the murder with his cell phone. The next vignette is actor John David Washington, Denzel Washington's son, who also plays the main cop in Black Klansman, as an NYPD officer who is sort of deeply struggling with what it means to be black and be an NYPD cop. And finally, you have Zirik. Yeah, Kelvin Harrison Jr. as Zirik, who is a high school student with tremendous baseball prospects. He's being scouted by, scouts for potentially, you know, the big leagues or at least a major college team. I don't really know how baseball scouting works. But anyway, and he feels a need to politically get involved in the wake of the murder of Darius Larson, who is the Eric Garner figure in this film.
Before we dive too far into it, I just want to say that. So Anthony Ramos plays Manny. I don't think we said who that was. He was in Hamilton. He's known for that, as well as many other things. Manny's wife is played by Jasmine Cephas Jones. And she was also the wife / girlfriend in Blindspotting. And I think she's delightful and wonderful. She was also in Hamilton. I am just kind of sad that the two movies that she's in this year, she plays the girlfriend or the wife character, right? She's there to push forward the stories of these dudes. And she's great. And I would like to see her star in things.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. She definitely deserves.
But she had, I think she had a significant role in Hamilton, but so not to say that she never gets that, but
but on screen.
Right. Mm-hmm. And these big movies about big things, you know, I don't know. They're all about dudes, right? And we talked about that when we talked about Blindspotting and when we talked about
Sorry to bother you.
Thank you. And so these are very important stories to tell, and the stories of black men are, or men of color in general, are very important, but also as we are seeing more of them this year, I'd like to see women being, you know, the stories of women of color and how their communities are like, how they are affected by this kind of violence and by, like, you know, the over-policing of these communities.
Yeah. And, you know, I am heartened that the activism that we see in both of these movies is largely led by women.
Yeah,
so both in this film with, I'm blanking on her name, Zoe, maybe. But the woman that that Zyrick sees on the street corner and who introduces him to the local efforts and organization that are rallying about Darius Larson's death, you know, obviously that's a woman. And then in Black Klansmen, you know, the cop's maybe, you know, girlfriend, you know, love interest in the film, also a very fired up woman. But yeah, these women, you know, like,
and it's right to bother you.
Yeah, like, you know, they're very. They're fairly circumscribed, and it's still part of that kind of casting of women as, like, you know, like the moral compass, you know, of men, the ones who, you know, men can look to kind of guide them. But in terms of, like, actually learning about the inner lives of these characters, you know, actually investing them with some three dimensionality, we don't yet quite have that.
Yeah, and I think that all three of these stories and, like, how wildly different each of these characters are and their experiences. So, like, regardless of where you stand in your life and what you're doing, you're going to be directly affected by this, by police brutality. And one of these stories could have been a woman, right? Like, very easily, it could have been the story of a woman in this community. So not to discount, like, the value of the film and not to discount the, like, the value of these specific kinds of stories by these specific kinds of characters. But, you know, that was I walked into the movie a little disappointed with that.
Definitely.
I really enjoyed this film. I had no idea, you know, beyond a week ago that this movie even existed. So, you know, I went into it with just, like, the barest minimum of an understanding of what the storyline was going to be. And to be quite honest, as a Black woman, I have to, you know, prepare myself for these kinds of stories, right? Because it just activates, like, the constant low level of anxiety and fear with which I navigate my world, you know, constantly. And so I have to really be in the right place to see what I know is going to be brutality against Black bodies. And I went in kind of girding my loins for this and determined to keep myself at kind of one level of remove so that, you know, emotionally I wasn't too overcome, which is a weird thing to do when you're going into a movie, to deliberately and explicitly set yourself up to not be too affected by something. So, you know, yeah, there's definitely a conversation to be had about the way that different audiences are going to watch and understand this movie. But as we get into it, the thing that I want to talk about, because the piece that I found most interesting and most valuable about this film was the middle vignette about Dennis, the cop, because I think this film is saying some really, really important things about complicity and culpability and about... There is there's kind of a facile understanding of, like structures of policing and oppression and police brutality that absolutely focus on the way that it props up white supremacy, but to date has not really reckoned with the way that how police officers of color also support those systems. And like the thin blue line and the way that, you know, it's about, at its root, it's about power and how power sets itself up. And so I really appreciated that there wasn't, like, Dennis the cop didn't have what to me would have felt like a kind of a come to Jesus moment and start participating in the activism that was going on around him, the protests, etc. He didn't walk away from being a cop because that would have felt false. That would have felt inauthentic to me, to the way that we know that, like, Black police officers actually do support their badly behaving fellow white officers, or the way that Black officers, you know, enact these horrible moments of violence themselves.
One of the things that I thought was really powerful about that vignette was how you see him, I guess, like, start to recognize that like there are, like the way that it's framed through his eyes is that there are some bad cops, right? Mm-hmm. Which is not a narrative that we accept. Mm-hmm. But that like, oh, that one dude is a bad guy. And like, I see that he's done things before and I watched the video and it actually happened. And you see him being like, kind of asking some questions internally to like other cops. But then as soon as he is taken to task, he is highly defensive and super like, you don't know what it's like to be a cop. You don't know what it's like to be like on the force and put yourself out there every day. And so that was I agree, Ebony, that like that was so much more authentic and realistic to what I imagine that experience was like. And watching that internal struggle, I think, was really interesting here and made this vignette so powerful.
Yeah, I think John David Washington's performance is exceptional because you see the pressure cooker inside him of this like growing, gnawing kind of conflict. And as so there's a scene where he and his wife have like another couple over for dinner or something, and the other woman engages him in a conversation, or kind of, you know, starts basically being the voice of like us, or like my thoughts, my perspective of you know, the basically the whole system is racist, it's fucked up, like and I found that the way he responded to her, the way he was so incredibly emphatic and just like unrelenting in his response, actually worked to reveal that inside, somewhere deep inside of him, he's not that certain at all. And I feel like he may be a figure who, when he was younger, you know, joined the police force, honestly thinking that he could do good. It would be like the right thing. And that now that his eyes are slowly being opened to the reality, like he cannot admit that to himself, because then the whole like house of cards inside of him that kind of justifies his participation in the police force and everything he does will come like collapsing down and just kind of destroy to some degree his whole identity. And yet we do see that facet of him kind of explode under the surface every once in a while. Like there's a moment where his son, like his wife puts his son in like an NYPD shirt because it's like at a day at school where kids are like supposed to be expressing pride in what their parents do or something. And Dennis gets like reacts very dramatically and says like, I don't want him wearing that. And I just found that moment so interesting.
Yeah, and the film opens with Dennis being pulled over. And at this point, we don't know that he's a police officer, being pulled over by a cop. And, you know, we see him going from, I think he's listening to Al Green and having kind of a, you know, just moment with himself, having a great day, to the face of fear, the expressions of fear that cross his face, and wariness and anxiety and, you know, frustration, all of these things. John David Washington, in fact, everyone in this film, the close-ups that we get of their face, like, they're so expressive. This isn't a film that's overloaded with too much dialogue, that's not packed with, you know, lots of back and forth. There are so many quiet moments, which I appreciated. But so we see Dennis pulled over, and it's not until the officer who pulls him over asks for his license and registration, and he gives it to him, that he says, you know, I'm on the job, and the job being a euphemism for I'm a cop, which matters not one whit to the cop who pulls him over. But then after he is allowed to go on his way, we don't see him again. We actually start with Manny. So we have that moment that then comes back when Dennis is talking to his partner in the squad car, and says, like, how many times have you been pulled over this year? You know, and tells her he's been pulled over 6. So he is aware of these things. He sees Scala, who is the person who committed the murder on Darius Larson. He sees Scala continuing to engage in this forceful, brutal policing. And so he's aware of these things that are going on, but he doesn't yet, as you say, Carol, have the ability to fully, like, acknowledge what this means. He is a witness to these things, but he's not yet someone who can take a stand over them.
Yeah. We also, during the Dennis vignette, we see, after a few officers are killed in the line of duty, we see this, when cops are killed in New York, the funerals for them are these massive,
yes,
like massive processions that are very dramatic. They're very kind of, visually, just the sheer volume of uniformed cops, like riding motorcycles and marching down the streets, is a powerful image. And, I couldn't help but contrast, like, oh, the funerals that these cops have gotten, and like how the funeral that results is this just show of complete solidarity and like unity, and cops have each other's backs no matter what. But also I couldn't help but compare that to how Darius Larson's has this just a modest little funeral in a funeral home. His life does not warrant the same kind of recognition of his passing. And I also thought it was an interesting little detail at Darius's funeral that we see that he's actually been dressed in military combat fatigues.
Yes.
So suggesting that he is a veteran, he served in the military. And I just find it so complicated and again just fascinating to kind of untangle or think about that, like, Darius Larson was killed by a mechanism of the state, mm-hmm. Because he's a black man. It wouldn't have happened if he hadn't been a black man. And yet still to kind of honor him, to give him the honor they felt he deserved in recognizing his life at the funeral, the thing they could think of, the kind of highest thing they could do would be to dress him in the fatigues of another institution of the oppressive kind of state, right?
Yeah, and that was so interesting because you would think the intuitive choice would have been he's a veteran, so to dress him in his dress uniform, right? But it's not. He's been dressed in his combat fatigues, as if to suggest there is a war that he is on, that he is still a soldier, or he was still a soldier, but removed from the battlefield and on the streets of Brooklyn.
I kind of want to go back to that dinner table, because I think it's related to the last vignette as well, where, you're watching this friend be like, hey, so police brutality, and everyone is trying to get her to stop. Her partner is trying to get her to stop. Like, the woman of the house, the cop's wife, is also like, maybe I should get dessert, right? Like, everyone is very, very uncomfortable, and we're uncomfortable watching it because she's breaking the social decorum of, you're in this guy's house and you are questioning his ethics and his morals. And it starts sort of like light, and then it grows, and you kind of expect her to back down. And I think that there's something valuable in witnessing the discomfort around other people when you bring up topics that they might not want to reckon with. And like the choice that you make to either be complicit and just let everyone remain feeling comfortable, or really push through that. Right. And I thought that watching that play out was an important moment.
Fact that she chose to leave, that she didn't apologize at the end and say, I'm sorry, let's just, have our dessert and try and paper it over. But the fact that she chose to leave, I was so grateful for.
The other thing, though, is that I'm like, but you're friends with these people and you've been friends with them for a while.
Yeah. Like, you didn't learn
and
today.
So, like,
he was
how
a
do
cop.
You not know?
Right.
Like, what? How did this not come up beforehand?
Sure,
like, I get that it's a narrative device, and I think it worked really well, but I also was a little like...
And I understand how something like the tragedy of Darius Larson in this, setting could be an opening for that kind of conversation.
Sure, but it's not the first time a cop is killed,
of course.
Like, or that the Brooklyn PD or whatever, right?
But I do agree with you that, I think we talk a lot about the importance of having really difficult, uncomfortable conversations in all kinds of spaces. We talk about, like, for instance, the importance of men in groups of men challenging their, you know, challenging other men when they make sexist comments or tell sexist jokes or what have you. And like, yeah, that's super uncomfortable and it's hard, but men need to start creating cultural standards within groups of men that say that, like, it's not cool. It's not okay to do that shit. And, you know, we rarely see, like, a real depiction of someone engaging in that kind of particularly uncomfortable.
Yeah, at the dinner table conversation.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, totally. And I think it's... Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I think it's related to the last vignette where Zyrek, I think it's that, whatever. I forget how they pronounce it. Is, you know, this rising baseball star, like he's being recruited by everybody and he sees the video and he sees what's happening and he, you know, he gets ruffled up by the cops for no fucking reason. And, he wants to do something about it. And so I think that there's something really beautiful about watching the, you know, a young person be like, enough. Like, I'm not just going to sit here and take this. I want to do something to change the system. So he joins this group of activists and, you know, I have some issues with the way that they like illustrate all of this, right? Like, you don't go... It's unlikely if you are an actual real activist that you like these people who went to do a sit-in, like, you know, that you're marching without a permit and the cops are going to shut you down and they're going to shoot pepper spray at you. And if you know, if they give you a dispersal, a notice of dispersal and you don't leave, then they're going to beat you up and they're going to pepper spray you and all of the shit that comes with that. So you plan for that as an activist. Like, you know, the people who are going to do that, you write down like lawyer numbers on your arm. Like, so the fact that he's been hanging out with them for so long and then he showed up and was like, oh, we're laying down now. I was like, that's a little, you would know that this was going on. Anyway,
I don't know. I feel like, you know, yeah, there are a lot of people who've been in the activism space for a while and who know that. But also with these kids, like these young people, sometimes they get caught up in the movement and they haven't been doing this a long time. They don't know these things. So you have the old heads who know that stuff, but how many of the old heads are there as opposed to like this kind of impromptu thing that happened? And
sure,
just,
but
you know,
this seemed planned to me. So I'm being a little like, it. None of this actually matters. I'm being a little bit like granular in a way that's not necessary, but like this looked like an action, right? Like, mm-hmm. I get very sensitive about the way activists are portrayed, right? And I don't think that they were portrayed badly. I just think that like, They had to do it for the emotionality of the scene for him to be like, I need to make a choice right now. Right. But I think that like these people would have already prepared for this outcome and he would have known because he's been hanging out for so long. Yeah. Maybe he didn't. Maybe he just went and like, that's fine. And he made that choice. And the whole time, I think as the audience, especially us who are older, we're sitting there being like, fuck, are you going to throw your chances away to, you know, like you're kind of, I wasn't with his dad at all, but I was very much like, oh, fuck. Well, like, what are you going to do? Are you going to throw your chances away at this, like, get, you know, sort of how his dad phrased it as like getting out versus like being an activist. And those aren't necessarily mutually exclusive, but sometimes they are.
Well, sure. I mean, it's interesting. So what you end up with Dennis and then Zyrek is a depiction of one black man who is remaining silent, like at any cost almost, and another, you know, black man who absolutely cannot remain silent. He finds that he cannot remain silent. And so, yes, the arc there is so fascinating because there's a scene where a baseball scout comes and sits down with Zyrek and his father at home. And he says something very important. He says that he's interested in character. He's not just interested in his performance out on the baseball field. Mm-hmm. He's interested in character. But what's so fascinating about that is that so in the end, at this scout day where all these young men, including Zyrek, are going out on the field to demonstrate their skills for scouts, Zyrek wears a shirt that says, I am Darius Larson. And to me, that is a tremendous display of character. But I also know that in the eyes of the baseball scout, it's probably the opposite. right? To them, they will see it as a liability. They will see it as, you know, just not something that they want to deal with. And I think that that, you know, that lens through which that kind of gesture is viewed, obviously, you know, from there we can go to a conversation about Kaepernick or, you know, athlete activism in general. But so we know that when athletes take these kinds of stands, the response is not always one of universal, like, praise and support by any stretch. And oh, also though, I feel like I totally understand where Zyrek's father is coming from. Like, he has just, for him, like, this is just the way it is. This is just the way the world is. And he has a son who has a chance to, like, get out to do something else. And, like, of course you'd want him to take that, and you would want him to do absolutely nothing to jeopardize that chance. So I really do feel for the father in this situation.
Yeah, and if you've been around for a while and you see this happen again and again, yeah, and again, and nothing changes, like, I totally get that impulse. But also, it's never going to change unless people do something about it.
Of course,
so,
but you don't, you want know, it to be your son, yeah, right, who has the you
yeah,
know.
Totally, which is not yeah, right, but
no,
also, like,
but it's totally understandable.
But also, I think one of the things that I loved about the final vignette with Zyrek and his dad is the way that it depicts how people who kind of live under the gun and under the shadow of the gun have to find moments of joy and find a way to live their lives every day that don't involve them completely surrendering to the fear. So, you know, there's that party that his dad holds for Zyrek before the night of his showcase, before he has that conversation with Zyrek about, yeah, I know this stuff goes on and it's always going to happen. So how do we find a way to live with it and not be beaten down by it? And I think it's important that we hear that message from someone from his generation, in the same way that in the first vignette with Manny, once Manny gets kind of galvanized and finally releases the video, his girlfriend says, you know, I'm not sure I want you to do this. D would want you to take care of your family. She knows what's at stake if he gets involved, if he's no longer anonymous to the cops, if he's considered to be a problem. And in that moment, I thought, yeah, you know, I bet D would have understood what she was saying. And I bet he would have told Manny to take care of his family and not put himself on the line, because for these older men who have lived through it, sometimes that's all you can do. Not every moment can be a moment of, like, fist raising protest. You know, sometimes you just want to be able to live your life the best way that you can. And sometimes that involves hunkering down. And so I kind of love that there was that juxtaposition of the, like, the generational difference of the understanding of this.
Two sort of separate. This is not a good transition to what you are all saying, but one is when Zoe comes, when Zyrek is like, I want to be an activist and I want to do, and she's like, are you all in? One of the things that they do is they go see Manny's partner. I forget what her name is. She and like brings her dinner and like checks in on her emotional well-being. And I really liked that moment of providing emotional support for the community, right? That this is actually about the people. And I think sometimes we forget that. And so that, I thought that was a nice touch. The other thing is, I kept thinking about, like, masculinity while we were watching this movie for so many reasons. And there are so many different but same displays of masculinity and masculine sort of conditioning. And there's a moment in the, and this comes in very strongly with the police, right? There's a very specific way that the police are trained to be. What's the name of the cop?
Dennis.
When Dennis walks in to the meeting where it turns out the cops were killed, the cop boss is like, come talk to me, talk to anybody, whatever, the fucking captain. But he's like, talk to me, talk to a priest, talk to somebody. If you need anything, I'm available. And I just kept thinking, like, that doesn't happen, right? Like, you are trained to not show emotions, to not share emotions. And you see that in the, like, Dennis's partner is a woman, and she makes, like, sexist comments to him about, like, shaving his balls and, like, you know, she's indoctrinated into this sort of masculine ideology, this very toxic, like, hegemonic masculine ideology. And so they're just that juxtaposition, which was, you know, it wasn't really meant to say anything or do anything, but you see this all the time. And I'm like, it's so hollow and empty because this institution does not allow for emotions, as does our larger institutions and our larger systems. So,
yeah. I would encourage people to go see this movie if you can. It's not playing everywhere. You know, like, I think it's primarily in major cities right now. And I had to find a theater that was playing. It wasn't, like, at the closest one to me. But go see it. Like, we didn't spend any time talking about, like, the actual craft of the film. I thought this film was so interesting to look at. Like, the cinematography was really amazing, the way that things were framed, often through doorways or windows or via reflections. And I absolutely loved the way the vignettes folded into and out of each other, the transfer from one character to another. Loved it.
Yeah, go see it, please. It's very lovely and sad and good. Okay, it's time for our... Oh, shit, I didn't think about a freak out.
I actually
have one.
Yeah, so. I do too this time. I have
time
one.
Weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, Carol, why don't you start?
Okay.
Oh, wait. Yeah. I need to announce this section so we can do the little ditty, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now it's time for What's Your Freak Out? Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Carolyn.
All right. So my freak out is, once again, but for the last time, Marvel's Spider-Man for the PS4, because I finished the story this past weekend. And, you know, I have some complex feelings about it. It does have, you know, as we talked about on a previous episode, there is absolutely the element of, like, propaganda. You know, Spidey's relationship with the NYPD is too much one of, like, you know, support and working together. However, you know, that aside, there's a great deal that I admire about the story. It's definitely probably the most, like, heartfelt narrative that I've encountered in the AAA open world action game format. You know, yes, Peter Parker is yet another, like, white male hero. However, he does have a kind of sincerity. He's not, like, a grizzled, cynical person. He's kind of idealistic. He genuinely, you know, has a spirit of, like, wanting to help people, but also for the way it develops its villains. You know, Dr. Octopus or whatever, Doc Ock, he's basically referred to in the game, you know, is a somewhat sympathetic villain. Like, you definitely get to understand why he's so driven to do the things he does. And while that doesn't make it right, like, there is definitely some, you know, there's definitely some level of, like, sympathy there. And, you know, the game develops to a point where Peter himself in the end has, like, a sort of, not unlike Doc Ock before him, Peter has, like, a very, very difficult kind of personal choice to make. And, you know, he makes, of course, the quote unquote right decision, but at tremendous, like, personal cost. And, you know, it's a powerful moment. I like that there's some focus on, like, community service. There's, you know, a kind of homeless shelter that plays a role in the story. Miles Morales gets involved there. I feel like this game puts more of a focus on like developing its characters and making you care about them and like them than a lot of games do. And you know, in the end, I really value that. I think, you know, Aunt May is probably, I mean, this is both saying something positive about Spider-Man and saying something negative about video games in general, but Aunt May is probably the best kind of most developed, like, older woman character that I've ever seen in a game, because when do older women basically even exist in video games? Not so often. Anyway, so, yeah. I think it's one of the... I have some problems with the design format, the open world game where there's a checklist of activities all over the map for you to do. I dislike that strongly, but I do think that this is one of the best games in that genre, both by virtue of its gameplay and also not insignificantly by virtue of its story and its characters.
You just love collecting backpacks.
Collecting backpacks is pretty fun.
Awesome. Ebony.
Anita.
What's your freak out?
My freak out this week is a bad freak out. This is not anything I'm happy with. So going back to something from the top of the show where I was talking about the experience of watching movies where you kind of have to gird your loins and prepare for it. This is part of what Phil, our producer, likes to say that I think in podcast segments, even if these segments are never going to come to life. So consider this a segment called Movies That Hate Us. I spent this past week, and I don't know why, watching movies that, you know, get talked about a lot in film criticism circles, some of which I had seen before, some of which I hadn't, but that I knew going in were like virulently like anti-trans or anti-black or anti-woman, because I felt like I needed to kind of figure out what was going on, maybe for a piece I'll write later, whatever, I don't know. So anyways, I spent this past weekend, I watched Psycho again, I watched Dress to Kill, and I watched Sleepaway Camp, and I feel completely traumatized, and I don't know why I make these bad decisions, and I don't know why I do these things, in a binge.
I just want to tell our listeners who may not know that Dress to Kill is a 1980, or I think very early 80s,
If you start by saying Brian De Palma, yeah, that's going to go a long way to explain and what's going to happen.
His films hate women just across the board, but this film has the added element of starring Michael Caine as a deranged, quote unquote, transvestite serial killer, right?
Yeah.
So good times.
Exactly. Just absolutely appalling, right? And here's the thing. I was kind of prepared, and as much as you can be prepared for that, because I knew it going in, but I hadn't seen the movie before, right? So what I was not prepared for was the horrible racism in the film. So there's this scene where, oh my God, there's a scene where Nancy Allen's character is running away from the serial killer, from the killer, and she goes down into the subway, and she is harassed and almost assaulted by this gang of black thugs, and it is so racist and so horrible. And I just thought, this movie needs to be burned to the ground. It is awful on every level. So my freak out is a freak out to myself. It's a voice memo that I will play for myself every time I'm about to fire up something new on Netflix, which is the segment of Movies That Hate Us. Don't do it. Don't do it.
Can we talk more about this in the bonus? Because I want to dive into this a little bit more. I got some thoughts.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Yes. I hope these thoughts are... You know, why did you do this? Why did you keep doing it once you realized you were in pain? Okay, good.
About your well-being.
Good. So, yeah, there we go.
Awesome. All right. So my freak out is that I have been watching a show called Humans, which is it's a show that it's a British show on Channel 4, but it's on Amazon Prime. The first two seasons are available for free if you are a Prime member. I guess it's not free. We should stop saying that.
Well,
they're available if you are subscribed for Amazon Prime. Yeah. The third season you have to pay for. So I watched the first two seasons. And so the show, I guess, is based on a Swedish show called Real Humans that the Brits remade. And I think it is produced jointly with AMC in the US. Anyways, I guess none of this matters. But it is a sci-fi show about conscious androids. And I've been really enjoying it. If I'm, you know, big sci-fi fan, this gets into, like, in this universe, there are androids that have been created for the servitude of humanity, right? You can buy them for your home. They're considered an appliance in your house and they can serve you. They work in mines. They work at coffee shops, and there's this whole sort of background current about the synths are what they're called, are going to take everyone's jobs away. And I think that there's something, while that is very background in this show, I think there's something really interesting that they do with the, it's as if these androids dropped into our current timeline, right? This isn't in the future. And so the fact that, having synths around to do labor that humans don't want to do or can't do, if it was outside of capitalism, there's an interesting conversation to be had about how people would be freed up then to do more creative, more social, more engaged things with their life. But it's not outside of capitalism, so people just fucking lose their jobs and then they can't pay their mortgages or rent or what have you, right? So there's stuff like that happening in here. The second season, I think, gets into some arenas that are really narrative arenas that I think are really interesting. So what happens when if there are conscious androids, what happens if you make all of them conscious, or if you want to even make all of them conscious? There's definitely a trolley problem thing that happens in this world. What does it mean for human relationships to synths if they're conscious? What does that look like? How would people respond to it? It brings up all of these questions, and there's all these other things that happens of so this is a bit of a spoiler, but I think this is really interesting. Is there is a little girl who I don't know, maybe 5 or 6, when her synth gets taken away, she can't deal with the emotional loss of losing someone she cares about, that she pretends to be a synth herself. So that that there are humans in the world called synthies that model synthetic behavior to avoid their emotional problems, which I think is really fascinating, right? So there's just a lot of layers here that are super up my alley. If you're into this kind of science fiction stuff, I think you'd be really into it. So Humans, it's on Amazon Prime. Check it out. All right. That's our show.
That's our show.
That's our show. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. Stay tuned for the bonus episode, which is only available to backers of this podcast, which can be you, by just heading over to d.rip/femfreak. If you're enjoying the show, please rate and review us on iTunes and tell your friends when you're sitting making posters for your next protest. Be like, there's this great podcast that cares about protests too. You can check out all of our work and our other podcasts at feministfrequency.com. Follow us on Twitter at FemFreak to stay up to date on all of the news. You can also follow each of us individually. I am at Anita Sarkeesian.
I'm at Carolyn Michelle.
I am at your house waiting for you to come home.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. You gotta stop watching those scary movies. Uh-huh. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music, technical support by Sarah Norales, art by Jamie Varon. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Later.